Our reading this evening will continue in 1 Thessalonians. We'll go to the second chapter, and I'll be reading verses 1 through 12. First Thessalonians, second chapter, verses 1 through 12. I'll be reading from the New International Version. You know, brothers and sisters, that our visit to you was not without results. We had previously suffered and had been treated outrageously in Philippi, as you know, but with the help of our God, we dared to tell you this gospel in the face of strong opposition. For the appeal we made does not spring from error or impure motives, nor are we trying to trick you. On the contrary, we speak as those approved by God who approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. We are not trying to please people, but God, who tests our hearts. You know, we never use flattery, nor did we put on a mask to cover up greed. God is our witness. We were not looking for praise from people, nor from you or anyone else, even though as apostles of Christ we could have asserted our authority. Instead, we were like young children among you. Just as nursing mother cares for her children, so we cared for you. Because we loved you so much, we were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of our God, but our lives as well. Surely you remember, brothers and sisters, our toil and hardship. We worked night and day in order not to be a burden to anyone while we preached the gospel of God to you. You are witnesses, and so is God, of how holy, righteous, and blameless we were among you who believed. For you know that we dealt with each of you as a father deals with his own children, encouraging, comforting, and urging you to live lives worthy of God, who calls you into his kingdom and glory.
Out for this evening. Hope you picked one up. If you read it already, you can go. I'm looking at causes of unbelief, even though this is part one. There's two parts. So we'll be looking at that. And I'm going to follow it with probably a look at six-parter on. We've gone through it before. Yeah, now, some of these things, people come up to me, oh, we've had this sermon before. Yeah, maybe second or third time. Out of 16 years I've been here, give me a break, okay? So if it's new, yeah, I always try to add a little something to it to bring it up to date, which I'll do with this one also. From Joshua 24:15, the reason I start with this is because even unbelief, what you believe, what you don't want to believe, whatever, it's a decision that you make for the most part. And this is what Joshua does in Joshua 24. He's standing before the Israelites, and they're about to enter into the land of Canaan. And he says, if it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourself whom you will serve. And he gives them a choice. You can go back and serve the gods of Egypt, where we just came from. Or as we move into Canaan, you can accept the Baals or whatever. He says, that's your choice. You do what you want. But for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. So a lot of the courses we have in this life, it begins with a decision. Unfortunately, when it comes to deciding to obey God, thankfully there's a lot of premises, facts, whatever that we can look at, and it takes us to a logical conclusion. We'll look at that. For unbelief, there's usually not any facts. Or skewed facts or whatever, and people just choose not to believe in God. Just a choice. And that's what we're going to be looking at this evening. As an introduction, beliefs and ideas, like actions, have consequences, because beliefs and ideas usually lead to actions. And there is consequences, so you have to be careful what you believe. Even if you think it's something you keep inside yourself and nobody will know about it, it will usually work its way out into some kind of action. Correct beliefs enable us to know the truth as it is and then to take appropriate action so that it will have the best possible effect in our lives. Conversely, however, incorrect beliefs are abundant and their effect is startlingly evident in the ungodly world around us. You know, why are things, sometimes the evil so prevalent, so much, you know, problems happening, so many causes for grief going on? Well, people are making bad decisions, and it has consequences. Okay? It's not God that created sometimes the world that we can't stand. It's all these bad ideas that people have and put into action. Practically no single belief has produced such debate as a belief in God. Why? Why does that, you know, bang against so many people's lifestyles, against so many philosophies and theories and everything else? And we'll look at that. It is responsible for some of the most impassioned speeches. It has generated millions of pages of text, pro and con. In the past, we've examined a multitude of reasons for belief in God. Like I said, we're going to get into a series of this. In this lesson, we would like to examine some of the causes of unbelief. So we're going to look at four or five tonight, and then, you know, equal number next week, Lord willing. And there's a good foundation for this, even as, you know, we're going through the secrets of the Quran in an Islam class. People often ask, how can people believe this stuff? You know, it just seems so detrimental, so weird, so violent, you know, whatever. How can people believe this? So it's a question that, you know, especially as a preacher, you get a lot. You know, people look at the world, how sad it is. They go, how do people live that way? What causes them to? Okay, so we're going to look at this. First of all, you're going to realize there is a bias against God. In many instances of unbelief, non-rational factors are a primary influence. As Stanley Sayers put it in his book, Optimism in the Age of Peril, one of the significant and obvious reasons the unbeliever remains an unbeliever is that he likes it that way. It's the course of least resistance. He's not held accountable, you know, to anything. So that's the way he wants to go. You know, it's got nothing to do with logic. It's a matter of dealing with desire. In fact, any evidence of any source or to any degree fails to move him from his position if his heart is strongly bent against evidence and toward unbelief. This sort of bias is seen in the life of Charles Darwin. He and his wife, Emma, began as believers in God. However, with the death of their oldest daughter, Charles could no longer believe in what he now considered an immoral and unjust world. Kind of blames God for that. In his own autobiography, he cast doubt on his own ability to reason because his reason always led him to the conclusion that there is a God. We've pointed this out before, and it needs pointing out, especially in this day and age when, you know, science is being held as a very irrational thing. In fact, something new I'll introduce to you. When Nancy was in Fresno, she heard someone say, I don't believe in God, I'm a scientist. Now, I heard the same thing down here from a different person. It's like the mantra that's coming out of the colleges. It's a way of dismissing any discussion, which is how they got where they are anyway. In fact, I've told someone that if you do not believe in God, that's your choice, but you did not get there by any scientific process. You did not look at both sides. You did not weigh the evidence, because frankly, there's more evidence for God than there is against it. Okay, so don't let them walk away and just dismiss you as an unintellectual kook, which is what they're implying. Take them back to their founder, Charles Darwin. Basically, he said, every time I let my reason, you know, flow, I find God. And in fact, you can see this most, you know, books of, you know, apologetics for, you know, whatever. The atheistic scientist kind of lives in a box that he doesn't go beyond. Like if you believe in the Big Bang Theory, you know, you go back and say, well, the universe started as a cosmic egg. Now, even Isaac Asimov said, if you ask the question, where did the egg come from, now we're into religion. Okay? So as you go outside the box, back to the beginning, you have to believe in only, you know, one of two things. Either matter always has been and always will be, or God always has been and always will be. And it makes more sense to believe in an intelligent designer than just matter that we know doesn't create itself. You know, you put dirt in a cup, and you can watch it all day long, and that dirt's not going to do a thing. Okay? Now, if you go the other way outside the box, if man is supposed to be getting smarter and stronger and evolving and all this stuff, at the end of that, you're going to find something that's evolved to the point of being God, which is what C.S. Lewis, you know, took us to. And who's not to say that perhaps that all evolution has already taken place and that's the God we're dealing with? So when you let your rationale go and your reasoning powers, you come up with God at both ends. So what Darwin said, and this is, if according to my theory, basically, I'm paraphrasing, if our reasoning capabilities came from unreasoning animals, how much can we depend on that ability to reason? They don't do it very well. So perhaps my reasoning there's a God has kinks and problems in it. So here's this basic scientist that proposed this theory, and he doesn't believe in thinking. So don't, as a scientist now, tell me that science is all that rationale, at least evolution. I have a great respect for other scientists. Paul, in his letters, notes the unnatural bias of the natural man. 1 Corinthians 2:14, but a natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God. We looked at this, was it last week or so, with the songs, and starting it off where Paul says, I'll sing with the Spirit, and I'll sing with the understanding also. And we broke it down into that, you know, Teachlet's biblical psychology, saying pretty much the spiritual side of man is what's attuned to God. The more spiritual an individual is, the more he can see the things around him. That, you know, that's God working and everything else. The heavens do declare the glory of God. If you squelch that, it's like having an atrophied muscle. It doesn't function. And if you don't tend to the spiritual side of your own nature, and you begin to blow out of proportion the natural side of it, the rational, reasonable, all this kind of stuff, you're no longer capable of receiving spiritual things. So they make, you know, they're foolishness to you. They don't make sense. You know, you've bent your antenna. And so you can't accept, you know, even the rational and reasonable things of God, you know, as he tries to reason with us. So they are foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them because they are spiritually appraised. You can't get there through the physical. This is why so many people say, well, you know, I just can't get to, you know, understanding God at all. And they automatically discount it because they've killed that side of them that would normally see it clearly. What did Elijah say? Open my servant's eyes that he may see what I see. Okay. Once, you know, your eyes are open, you'll see a lot of things about God around you. I remember the incident of our first astronauts in outer space, and they look around and they read from Genesis, you know, what a beautiful place that God has created. And then the cosmonauts go up, you know, who've been trained, you know, in an atheistic society, and they go, I don't see nothing. You know, where's this God that you're talking about? Paul in his letters also notes the unnatural bias of the natural man. Romans 1, beginning of verse 21, he says, even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God. Now, one of the things you can get from this is that there's something inside of us that God has put that we would seek God. If not inside, then outside, because Paul says, you know, he does all these things around us, and he's not far from us that we might seek him. you have to make a decision to squelch all that, the inside and the out. In fact, sociologists will basically point out, even though they're coming from a different perspective than religion, that man is basically a worshiping animal, the way they put it. That is, as you study anthropology and all the different societies and time periods, the people worship something. When they're not worshiping the one true God, they have a tendency to degenerate in their practices and their worship, but they're still worshiping something. It's like something inside of them is forcing them to look to something greater than themselves. Their foolish hearts are darkened, professing to be wise, they became fools. In biblical uses, the term fool generally does not indicate a person of diminished intelligence. Instead, the term carries both a moral and a religious judgment. Thus, the psalmist writes, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." So in his heart, he's made the decision, "I'm not going to believe in a God." And he started on the wrong path. Like I said, it doesn't necessarily mean somebody who's diminished in capacity. I was reading the Skeptical Inquirer one time, and mostly because of the person that wrote the article, the amazing Randy, who's a magician, and he debunks the paranormal. He goes out and shows all the stuff that people think are weird, whatever. It's just basically a con job. In fact, he can duplicate everything they do and better. He's smart because he belongs to Mensa, which are a group of the top 2 or 3% intellects. That's something that's got to be explored itself. I started doing some research into IQ and whatever, and Jim Fix said, if you're looking into IQ, they actually went to the guy who invented the IQ test and asked him, what is IQ? If anybody would know, it would be him. And he said, "It's what my test measures." That's what you're prey to in this world. Okay. Now, I bring this up about James Randi is because he went to Mensa. They invited him to speak. And he starts telling them, showing them how the paranormal is a lot of garbage. And he got thrown out because these top smart people believe in UFOs, ghosts, paranormal, and everything else. No proof for it, but they believe in it with a passion. So when we talk about smart people, you're going to find, no matter what your IQ is, the smartest person on this planet is the one that believes in God and trusts in his wisdom. Another cause of unbelief can be how we're brought up and who brought us up. Generally speaking, mothers and fathers have not only an initial, but also a continuing effect upon their offspring. The minds of children are basically blank slates upon which parents have a grand opportunity and responsibility to write. This is why, as Christian parents, we have a great responsibility to make sure the world does not get its ideology stamped on our children. We need to do the teaching at home. Otherwise, it's going to have an opposite effect. And that means not just teaching, but also being an example. Sometimes this is accomplished through nurture and admonition, Ephesians 6:4. Sometimes it is accomplished by discipline. Sometimes it is accomplished by exemplary behavior. If Ephesians 6:4, we're familiar with, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. So instruct them about God, what is right, what is good, what's moral, from God's standpoint, in discipline. Reward them when they do good. Disciplining, to determine what it is, in order to deter bad behavior. The rod and the reproof give wisdom, but a child who gets his own way brings shame to the mother. And sometimes it's interesting how the child is smarter than the parents. Why does a child get its way? Because it does something that's so irritating to the parents that they will give him what he wants in order to shut him up or making behave. And the child then rewards the parent for that particular training by, you know, doing something nice or, you know, behaving the way they want him to. So basically, he's manipulating the parents. The parents need to get smart enough to be able to manipulate the child. When he starts doing something that's inappropriate, make his life a living punishment. Okay, I'm trying to keep away from certain words that might offend somebody. But just pour it on. It could be a timeout. It could be withdrawing something from him, or maybe just taking him out and applying a good old rod in the right place. Now, of course, there's cautions here. Don't do it when you're angry. Make sure they understand why they're being punished. Make it quickly associated with the wrong they were doing, and afterwards give them a hug and let them know that you still love them and all that. But don't worry sometimes about punishing. If you're in the right mind, you're not abusing them, you're not killing them, whatever. Because you love them and you know it's necessary, you will stop in time. As one child psychologist put it, sometimes we worry, in a politically correct society, that we might be damaging their psyche forever. Well, if the kid, in the example he uses, if a kid goes up to the stove and grabs a hot plate or a hot pan or something like that, he's going to come away crying. But he doesn't come away with scarred psyche, hating pans for the rest of his life. He's just learned an example that if I do this, it hurts. And he doesn't do it again. He's learned his lesson. So sometimes a little corporate punishment. In fact, as we call it corporal punishment, we do it to adults with more lasting effect. When they don't get any kind of training as a child, it's more severe as an adult when we finally have to discipline them. As an example, notice God says, for the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, his ears attend to the... This is something you can teach the kid. When you're doing the right thing, you got your parents on your side and you got God on your side. He's sitting there helping you through things. But notice... But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. If you're doing wrong, not only do you have society against you, you got God against you. And that's something really to consider. The obvious corollary is also true. The inaccurate instruction, lack of discipline, improper example can produce disaster. And that's what the world is made up of. One noted child psychologist expressed it this way: I believe that much atheism has the ground prepared for it in the disillusionment with the parent which has arisen in the child. Because he can't see God in his parents, he's got no conception of God. Stephen Jay Gould, as an example, one of the foremost evolutionary atheists, Harvard graduate and designated 1983 Scientist of the Year, learned his atheism from his Jewish parents, who abandoned all theology and religious belief. This is where he also picked up his devotion to Marxism, all which will probably be passed on to his children. Another cause of unbelief, education. Not only from lack of it from the parents, perhaps, but also as the system we plug them into. Not all education is related to unbelief, but unbelief is related to certain kinds of education and different sources of it. The educational system in America, and this is what we have to be careful of, and in many other countries now, is a product of John Dewey's progressive education movement. Anytime you see the word progressive, like in Hillary Clinton, she uses the word a lot. We're talking socialism. We're talking Darwinism. We're talking humanism. Dewey was a socialist, a material pantheist, and one of the founders and first president of the American Humanistic Association. One of the most important tools employed by Dewey was the teaching of organic evolution. The assumption of progressive education is that the child is simply an evolved animal and must be trained as such. This means that they're not allowed a belief in God or religion. It's no wonder then that many a God-fearing youth has gone to college and sitting at the feet of, quotation, learned men who live in a world of almighty science and know everything through their empirical thinking gets turned away from this world where people just spiritually believe things. Okay, we get a bum rap in the academia circles, but realize where it's coming from. We began by talking about, you know, what your beliefs are and your consequences. And as we look at the world, you have to realize, you know, the consequences that we see, where did they come from? Well, Darwin may have been just, you know, nice, you know, I think Darwin was 22 when he came up with all this, and what he put down may have been plagiarized to begin with. Read the book Conviction. But, yeah, you know, and himself, you know, admitted not to be that smart an individual. But his theory took off. It got beyond him. Even when he looked at his book 10 years later and go, you know, most of the theories in it are already proved to be, you know, bogus. That didn't matter. Because one of the people that were interested in it was Adolf Hitler. And fascism in Nazi Germany builds itself on the ideas of survival of the fittest. And Darwin's Book of Origin of the Species was his Bible. And we reap the results of it. Communism also, too. We're talking about regimes where millions, tens of millions of people have died or been enslaved. That's the result of not believing in God and going along with an animalistic viewpoint of our development. Here's the choker in our society. Before Nazi Germany emerged, if a person was getting get a healthy degree in anything, you know, in a university, he had to go to Germany to get it. That was considered the center of religious, or not religious, but academic learning. One of our presidents, Woodrow Wilson, was a graduate of those universities. And that's why he came back here and started the progressive movement. Even it has gotten away and out of hand. When he can, if he would be able to see what progressivism is now, he'd be spinning in his grave. But he got it started, and it's gone from there, and it's taken over our society in trying to wedge God out of it. It is true that most scientists believe in evolution as a fact, but not really because they have proved it to themselves. Kierkegaard, which is in our handout, we went through this before, and I've got his book, Implications of Evolution. He sits, he's an evolutionist. You know, he claims to be an evolutionist, and he sits on the board of those that screen graduates from the universities, you know, up for their PhDs. And in his introduction, what he screams is the fact that you sit there and you talk to these young minds and you ask them, you know, do you believe in evolution? Oh, yeah. Okay, how do, why do you? You know, how do you prove it? Well, Darwin proved it. And that's the amount of depth they go to. He says he can't believe, you know, how much they believe that they have no substance for. In fact, he wrote the book, Implications of Evolution, to present seven major areas in science where the evolutionist has to have more faith than the Christian because there's absolutely no proof for what they buy into. Like life coming from non-life. How can that happen? You've got no proof for it whatsoever. But that's what you bought into, and you call it science and thinking. As someone once observed, the main reason most educated people believe in evolution is simply because they have been told that most educated people believe in evolution. Boy, talk about a propaganda machine. Or I don't believe in God because I'm a scientist. Same thing. Just because a majority believes something does not make it right. In truth, the majority is usually in the wrong. I mean, it didn't work when the emerging scientists look at religion and go, well, just because all these people believe in religion doesn't make it right. Well, just because all these scientists believe in evolution doesn't make it right. Moses warned, thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil. Nothing wrong with following a multitude to do good, but be careful that you get sucked into something where you're just brainless among the herd and don't really know what you're doing. Another source is pride. Jesus summed up one of the main reasons many are unprepared to believe in God, because man is too busy seeking and revealing and reveling his own glory. We looked at, in Islam, the appeal to the baser part of man. I mean, this is what Muhammad was going for. You get people in, if you promise to feed their baser nature, sex and violence. That's the basis of the religion. In America, the basis of evolution is pretty much your own pride. Okay? Where man becomes the god. Jesus asks, how can you believe when you receive glory from one another and you do not seek the glory that is from the one and only God? This is where your glory is going to come through in life. Are you following God? Are you drawing from his wisdom and not man? The intellectual revolution was assessed by historians Ferguson and Bruin by the new learning offered man a more vainglorious picture of himself and rooted itself in his pride, whereas his religious beliefs had been the fruit of his humility. You see, there's an arrogance in the intellectual community. Because they have a few degrees, they think they're king of the earth. But if they took all the learned people in all the universities in all every time that ever lived and stacked up all their intelligence to God, it'd be like it never existed. The renowned biblical scholar Wilbur M. Smith observed, when man says he believes in a supreme being, he's at the same time, if he is honest, confessing that God is holy, that he himself unholy, that God is independent and can do according to his own will, while man is dependent. That's your picture of reality, if you believe in God. For the individual that thinks arrogantly that he's self-made, someone once said, or self-taught, the man who self-taught had a very ignorant teacher. Or the person that thinks that they can do it all on their own, that they don't need anybody, which a lot of young people do. We mentioned this. Take them out in the middle of the desert and turn them loose. See how well they survive. The house that you build in, the car that you drive, did you build it? The food you eat, did you grow it? The clothes you wear, did you make them? How much are you depending on all of society? You're not independent. And this is what you have to learn. We need to learn to work together, and especially with God. Note the pride of the man like Richard Leakey, who wrote, we can, if we choose, do virtually anything except convince his own son the worth of some of his theories. When Richard Leakey Jr. came up with the Lucy, he destroyed the whole theory of daddy. The arrogant heart cannot furnish fertile soil for the seeds of truth. If you think you know it all, how is anybody going to tell you anything, even God? That's the problem with arrogance. This is why Paul says, in your religious practices, if you go beyond what is written, it's arrogance, because you think you know how to do it better than God. Especially when he tells you how to worship him, and you think you know a better way. Mark 7:4, from within, out of the heart, proceed evil thoughts, fornications, thefts, murders, adulteries, deeds of coveting and wickedness, as well as deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. And when Hollywood tells you, just follow your heart. Seriously? Yeah, we've covered this one before. Pride goes before destruction. Last thing, we're kind of running out of time. So think about the teenager who rebuffs his friend's invitation to do drugs, the employee who chooses not to fudge his timesheet, the college student who elects not to cheat on the exam, and all sorts of, the athlete who chooses not to use steroids or drugs. What kind of flack do they get? Because they're kind of in the minority sometimes. They get mocked. You know, for doing the right thing. And so a lot of times our immorality comes from our peers. It takes a lot of courage. You know, when everybody is... Now, why do you get so much flack to begin with? Why is this pressure there to do what's wrong? Aldous Huxley, who went along with, you know, kind of helped, really spread Darwin's stuff. Darwin's kind of a timid little guy. Huxley, you know, jammed it through. He said, he admitted, I had motives for not wanting the world to have meaning. It was essentially an instrument of liberation. We object to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. Now, when you do this, basically what you're doing is giving yourself over to your baser elements. And we make excuses for it. I'm only human. Everybody else is doing it. I have to sow wild oats. You know, it's just part of the course of being, you know, what people do. Everybody's doing it in a sense, you know, whatever. And so we make these excuses. But it gets down to, why is the devil so adamantly against us? Ephesians, the first chapter, kind of gets into it, but you have to read, you know, read into it in the original. Basically, it's because, you know, probably the devil himself thought, well, God's being unreasonable, you know, and I want to do my own thing. But when you find that there are people that go along with what God says, that do it His way and become successful, that it's not that hard. With God's help, they can overcome and be more than conquerors. That really makes other people mad, because what you've done is just shown them up that all their excuses mean nothing, and they're mad about it. You've accomplished something they can't because they didn't want to, and they've been caught in it, and they're going to come down on you, and you're going to have to be ready for it. Okay? The rest of the people they run with have given in to their pressure. When you don't, that marks you. You know, you've now become an enemy. Even if you don't overtly do it, you know, come out and say things, the fact that you're living right is proof. It's a monument to how wrong they are. And they're going to call you goody two-shoes, and why don't you do this, and you know, whatever, and the mocking is going to begin, and sometimes the violence is going to be part of it. And that's all part of where it all comes from. Smith again concluded, one of the deepest, profoundest, most powerful causes for unbelief holding men back from Christ is a life of sin. They think they got sucked into it and they can't get out of it and there's no other way. In fact, Warren just gave me an article about a girl who was homosexual, and she gave her life to Christ and the power of the scriptures worked. And she said, I just had, you know, one day, different desires. She met a young man, they got married, they had a child, and man, are the homosexuals coming after her. Although she's pretty overt about it. She's telling you, you can do it. You can overcome it. You're not locked into it. But they want to be locked into it. They want the excuses. And therefore, there's going to be problems. In Romans 3, it is written, there is none righteous. Paul comes out and says, yes, this is a Jewish belief. You know, at one point, it was so bad, it seems like nobody's doing anything right, you know, so why don't we just all go together? And it appears like none's doing righteousness, none that understands, none who seeks God. You know, and sometimes our world feels like that. But it's right in the middle of a very positive book where, or letter, where Paul is telling us there are the right things to do. And we can do it with the power of God. We can overcome. There's a, the song we're about to sing goes along with what we opened up this sermon with, is that evil is often a decision. But doing the right thing is a decision too. And I hate to quote it, you know, I might caution you against this. Don't ever pick up a book on the origin of things. You know, to find out, it'll you know, dispel your little universe. How many times have you heard it quoted, the journey of 1,000 years begins with a 1,000 miles begins with a single step? Who do you think said that? Good Oriental philosophy, whatever. Somebody said it's Confucius, Lao Tzu. You know what the source of it is? A 1937 Charlie Chan movie. It sounded Oriental, and so they inserted it in his mouth. But it makes sense. Yeah. An decision means you got to take a single step. So we'll go with it anyway. You need to make a decision in your life, if you haven't already made it, to serve God, to start doing the things that are right. It just starts with a beginning step. And as long as you know, that first step is pointed in the right direction, the next step kind of follows. Even if it's a baby step, until you get a momentum going. And now you've changed your whole life, a whole different direction of the way you've been living. And this is what God is calling us to make this kind of decision. You know, starts off easy, and God will be there with you for the rest of it until your journey's end. Won't you come as we stand to sing?